Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We have the privilege on this program of being graced from time to time, indeed pretty regularly, by Gordon G. Chang. He is one of our country's leading experts on the great threat of our time, that would be the Chinese Communist Party. I'm very pleased to say there are a number of others who have been acknowledging the importance of the work that Gordon does, including Donald Trump at CPAC, and more recently, Mark Levin on his evening program on Sunday at Fox News. We know what they know, which is that Gordon is a go-to resource on the kinds of dangers that are associated with especially underestimating the character and the agenda of Xi Jinping, a dangerous dictator and a megalomaniacal would-be world power. We're going to talk with Gordon about that and much more in the course of the next three segments, and I just want to encourage all of you to do as I do, and that is follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. You can also find his writings at Newsweek and 1945, Epoch Times, and elsewhere. And, of course, you can look for him here, and I hope you will continue to do so. Gordon, welcome. It's a little bit of a long-winded introduction, but I just wanted to make known my supreme pleasure at the extent to which others are singing your praises, as we're privileged to have the chance to do. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
Congratulations on it all. So, Gordon, we haven't spoken since the Xi Putin summit in Moscow. You followed it closely. You've been commenting about it elsewhere, and I'd like to get your thoughts on what the so-called No Limits partnership looks like now in its aftermath.
It looks even more frightening than when it was announced on February 4th of last year. When Xi Jinping parted from Vladimir Putin, the Chinese leader said this. He said, "Change is coming that we have not seen in 100 years. And then he said to Putin, "And you and I together will be driving this change." And that really says that in Xi Jinping's mind, that China and Russia are ruling the world, and that the United States is no longer a factor. Now, I'm not saying that Xi Jinping's assessment is correct, but it doesn't matter what's correct. It matters what Xi Jinping himself is thinking, because that will drive his behavior. And his behavior has become extremely aggressive, and he's preparing for war. There's no question about it. So we're in the last moments of peace unless something changes. And right now, I don't see anything changing.
Yeah. Deterring all of that would be the kind of change I think we both would like to see. And that's what's particularly absent at the moment, I fear. And Gordon, one other thing that he said in the course of those parting remarks, as I recall, was he called Vladimir Putin my dear friend, something that I think Putin said of him as well. Again, this bespeaks for public consumption, this idea that they're now joined at the hip, I guess one might say. Talk to us about what the strategic implications of that are. If indeed Xi is bent on war, what kind of role do you see his dear friend playing in support?
China and Russia will be fighting the war together in all probability, because they've been planning to. There have been joint military exercises between the two of them for quite some time. So this is going to be a global war. It's going to be fought over many areas, including on the first day, Frank, this war in Asia will be fought on American soil. The Chinese are going to turn off our lights. They're going to turn off the water. They'll probably detonate explosives across the country. They'll create chaos. So this war is coming home. And we Americans are not prepared for this. We haven't had civil defense since the Clinton era. And the Biden administration really right now has no clue as to what can occur. And I think what will occur. In addition, Biden's Pentagon, and this is not entirely his fault. We have a Pentagon right now that thinks that if war with China occurs, it'll be no sooner than 2027. We have the Navy trying to retire ships, the Air Force trying to take the F-22 out of service, or some of them, because they want to, as they say, divest to invest. In other words, to pay for the force of the future. Well, if we're going to have a war with China, it's going to be today, tomorrow. It's not going to be in the 2040s or the 2050s.
And Gordon, there's a lot to unpack there. I have been for some time persuaded that American territory would be targeted by the Chinese Communist Party in the event of war. But you've really taken it to another level in terms of both attacks here in the American homeland and of the kind that we know is part of their doctrine in the event they go to war with us, namely using electromagnetic pulse or other means of taking down the grid that would turn off the lights and deny us water and all manner of other, you know, necessities of life. This would not be just, you know, means of keeping the United States from engaging to support Taiwan, as would say attacks on American territory in Guam or American bases in Japan or South Korea, perhaps. This would be taking down the United States for all intents and purposes. So this is a war for, you know, the primacy that Xi clearly seeks, but going right at it with us. That's your assessment, if I understand you correctly?
Absolutely. Xi Jinping has been pressing the notion of Tianxia, or all under heaven, that Chinese emperors not only had the obligation to rule all under heaven, had the right to, but also the obligation to. And, you know, it's not just ruling the entire planet Earth that they're thinking of. Since 2017, Chinese officials have been talking about the moon and Mars as sovereign Chinese territory. So all under heaven is meant to be literal. And really what we're talking about is totalitarian rule by one individual, Xi Jinping.
I wish I could disagree with you, Gordon. I wish particularly that I could say, well, no, you're wrong about the fact that they're actually preparing to act on these ambitions. But we did a very impressive webinar last week. As you know, we talked about this preparation being quite far advanced by the Chinese Communist Party, to the point where I think it's the general consensus of our friends, including your good self and our Committee on the Present Danger of China, that they're basically good to go. This could happen quite literally, as you've suggested a moment ago, at any moment, not 2027, not, you know, 2040. To the extent that that is the case, Gordon, again, you would anticipate that the Russians would be pulling in alongside and engaged in some of these attacks against us as well?
Because they've been exercising together, yes, the answer is we have to assume that if we have a war with China, Russia will come in on China's side. And it's not just China and Russia, it's their proxies as well. So we're talking about North Korea, Iran, Pakistan, Algeria. So this means conflict at both ends of the Eurasian landmass, plus North Africa, and perhaps other places as well.
I want to talk to you about some of those other places as well. Gordon, on the other side of a very short break, we'll be right back with more with Gordon G. Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If elected president, Senator Barack Obama promised a fundamental transformation of the United States of America. In the course of what's been called his third term, a nominal Biden administration dominated by Obama's staff is in the process of fundamentally transforming the world. Reflect, for example, on the Middle East at the end of Donald Trump's presidency. Our most important regional ally, Israel, had arguably never been stronger. Its strategic alliance with the U.S. was robust, encouraging stability through peace accords with former adversaries and isolating and deterring their common enemy, Iran. As an extremely timely Center for Security Policy webinar yesterday made clear, Israel is now isolated, undermined by Biden's Obama retreads, dangerously divided at home and facing an array of emboldened foes, including a nuclear-capable Iran, backed by communist China. That's a formula literally for disaster. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We're having a very bracing conversation, I think it's fair to say, with Gordon G. Chang, one of our duty experts on all matters. And Gordon has just expressed the opinion with which I'm afraid I agree, that war is imminent with the Chinese Communist Party, the old-fashioned kind of war, not just the unrestricted pre-kinetic kind, but the shooting kind. And that they will target us here at home, as well as some of our far-off assets and territories in the Western Pacific. Gordon, this is all chilling stuff, needless to say, but it's made worse by something that you alluded to there at the very end of the last block, and that is that the Chinese have been beavering away now for years at something that Xi calls the Belt and Road Initiative, whereby large parts of the world from, you know, one end of the planet to the next is now effectively being colonized by the CCP. Some 147 countries, I believe, are now involved in one way or another, to one extent or another, with China in this regard. How does that translate into the capacity to wage a truly global war, unlike anything we've ever seen before, to our great detriment, needless to say?
China is building, in addition to other things, ports. And some of those ports in wartime could be used by the Chinese military. And to talk to you about where some of those ports are, well, They've got facilities at both ends of the Panama Canal. They have a container port in Freeport in the Bahamas, which is under 90 miles from Palm Beach. You know, they're now trying to get a facility at the tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego. So, you know, this is comprehensive. You know, they've got problems with Belt and Road. I mean, we hear about their loan extensions, countries not being able to repay, China repossessing. And this is a problem for China as well as for the debtors. But the point is, in the here and now, they've got port facilities which they have access to. And these are around the world.
Yeah. And in many cases, whether they're building them or not, they are controlling them. And that may even include some in our own country, which is a fearsome prospect, as they do control parts of our electric grid, or have the capacity to, if they choose to, through transformers that they've put inside our wire, quite literally. So you might not require an electromagnetic pulse to shut down the grid. You simply turn off or destroy those transformers. This is a huge vulnerability, and we've been warning about it for many years. It's long overdue that we address and remedy it. Gordon, let me come back to Russia one more time. On the Ukraine front, arguably the first front in this global war, World War III, some are calling it, the Chinese have been seemingly playing a double game here. They would like the rest of the world to think that they are critical of, or at least discouraging of, the kind of conflict that Putin has been waging in Ukraine. And yet, on the other hand, I think there's very little doubt that they greenlighted the invasion back at that summit you mentioned in Beijing in last year. But also, Gordon, that they are materially aiding and abetting the invasion. Your take on that?
Yeah, China has been all in on this, and it's been financing the war effectively with elevated commodity purchases. It's opened up its financial system to Russian institutions that have been sanctioned. China's put its diplomats in service of the Kremlin. Chinese propaganda outlets, both central government and Communist Party, have been amplifying Russian disinformation. And China's been supplying lethal assistance, and it's been quite open about it recently. You have the drone sales to Russia's Wagner Group. There's been reporting that each or almost every day, an AN-124, which is the largest cargo plane in the world, leaves Zhengzhou in central China, carrying ammunition and other high consumption rate items. The Biden administration keeps on saying, well, the Chinese are only contemplating, the word they use, contemplating the supply of lethal assistance, and that would be a red line. But China's already been doing it, and the Biden administration won't impose those costs on China for doing so. So right now, all Xi Jinping hears are hollow warnings from the White House.
Right. Do you think, Gordon, that even before they became rather more open about providing such lethal assistance, that they've been doing it as well, that this has been going on for some time under the radar, under the table?
It's been going on from the beginning of the war, though in different forms. In the very first moments of the war, China was feeding location data to Russia. Ukraine was operating Chinese-made drones. So China knew the location of the operators of the drones. Beijing fed that to Russia, and Russia was then able to use that to take out the Ukrainian drone operators. That's lethal assistance. But now it's become much more open because, for instance, Ukraine is reporting a spent Chinese ammunition on the battlefield fired by the Russians. And we saw that drone, Chinese drone, on the ground in Ukraine after it had been taken down. So right now it's more open. But from the very beginning of this conflict, China was there providing lethal assistance.
And as you say, the administration has done little besides issue hollow warnings at best. And mostly it seems as though they're sort of ignoring the whole thing. As they are, it seems, Gordon, something that you've addressed at Newsweek recently, and that is the efforts the Chinese are making with considerable success, I'm sorry to say, in supplanting the United States as a leading, or if not the dominant power, certainly external to the region, in the Middle East. Talk a little bit about why we should care that the Chinese are doing that and doing so successfully, as I said.
Well, China is now the dominant foreign power in the Middle East. It's fully backing Iran. It's flooding the region with weapons through Iran. And they've brokered peace recently between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That's allowed a couple things. One of them is Beijing is pressuring Saudi Arabia to take renminbi in payment for oil. And the Saudis are not stupid, so they're resisting that. But nonetheless, we will probably see some sales of hydrocarbons and in denominated in renminbi. So, of course, that means the petrodollar is in jeopardy. So there's all sorts of things. And by the way, Frank, this is a collapse of American foreign policy, because during the Trump 4 years, we had the best Middle East policy of any American president since FDR. FDR solidified the relationship with the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. And Biden's had the worst. Biden has, for various reasons which don't benefit American interests, have initiatives that have opened the door to China And indeed, Biden policy right now is supporting Chinese policy, which is directed at getting the United States out of the region. This is just hideous.
Well, unfortunately, it would be bad enough if that's all that one could point to in this connection, Gordon. But we have to take a short break here, and I just want to set it up by saying it seems to me that what you've just described in terms of weakening America's position, in this case in the Middle East, or enabling the Chinese to fill a strategically important vacuum, in this case, again, in the Middle East, is actually something that you can point to literally around the world, including to varying degrees inside our own country as well. I want to probe that proposition with you, Gordon Chang, on the other side of this short break. Follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang and follow him into the next segment by staying tuned. We'll be right back.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversation, I'm pleased to say, with Gordon G. Chang. He is the author of a number of very important books, including, you can find him with profoundly important and increasingly, I think it's fair to say, influential essays in all the right places, and of course, on television screens and shows like this across the country. And we're always grateful to him for his time. And I, particularly, Gordon, because you're speaking very pointedly now about things having reached a possibly decisive tipping point with respect to the Chinese Communist Party, its ambitions globally, and the danger that it poses to us, not simply in the form of the kind of, as they call it, unrestricted warfare they've engaged in for decades against us, but now potentially of the materially, existentially perhaps, threatening kind of shooting war. To the extent, Gordon, that the Biden presidency, I'm of the view that this is really Obama's third term, is sort of bringing to full fruition the fundamental transformation that Barack Obama promised on the eve of his first election to the presidency. It does seem as though basically every policy that this president has been pursuing has had these two characteristics. One, they've been bad for America, and two, they've been basically beneficial to the Chinese Communist Party. To the extent, we're, as it happens as we speak, going to be doing a webinar on this subject at the Committee on the Present Danger China. People can find it at presentdangerchina.org. On the question of whether we can, in fact, defeat the Chinese Communist Party if we have what I call the Chiden administration, working to advance the interests of the Chinese Communist Party rather than, you know, protect ours at their expense. Your thoughts as to whether that's a tenable proposition at this point?
There are a couple of things here. First of all, there's the flow of Chinese money to the Biden family. And this month, we saw a very startling admission from Hunter Biden's legal team. The Biden family received more than $1 million from a Chinese company. And the Biden, Hunter's team actually said, look, this was, quote, good faith seed funds. Well, that was an admission of corruption, because corruption is the only explanation for that type of payment in these circumstances. Nobody would pay seed money, when you're talking about deals of this sort. So we really now have to be concerned about the money. And money leaves a trail, so we will find out about it. But also the other thing about Biden is that forget about the money, forget about the corruption issues. The point here is that Biden has a view of America and the world that is completely out of date. I mean, if it was ever applicable, it was only 3 decades ago. And even then, one should criticize it for not being correct. But the point is, it is now so totally out of date that what he is doing is he's, as you say, effectively helping our enemies, and he is fatally undermining the United States.
Fatally undermining is a very strong term, obviously. But again, for reasons that we've been discussing, Gordon, I don't think it's overstated at all. And another way in which this is being done is an assault on our energy sector and its capabilities. And as is true of most of what's been going on here, as you know better than just about anybody, this is a function of the combined efforts of the Chinese externally and enemies within domestically. I'm thinking here about the efforts to deny the United States the use of fossil fuels, to force our conversion wholesale to products instead that mostly are manufactured in China. At the same moment that, notwithstanding its professed concerns about the environment and climate change and so on, the Chinese are busily building coal-fired power plants and otherwise making extensive use of fossil fuels. Talk us through this as one of the other vectors of the warfare that the Chinese have been waging against us, Gordon.
The Paris Accords give China an incentive to pour more carbon into the air until, quote, around 2030, which is when they promise to cap their emissions. So the Paris Accords, are accelerating climate change rather than retarding it. And I think that when you look at that, was the fundamental flaw in all of this. But, it's also been aggravated by Biden, who just a couple days ago blamed the Republicans for prejudicing America's energy security, which is a really curious comment, because as you point out, we were the world's number one producer of oil and gas. We were self-sufficient. That was largely the result of the Trump administration deciding to use energy to further American goals throughout the world. And what Biden wants is clean energy. And that's a long conversation. But the point is that to have clean energy, you need to have products from China. So we're increasing our dependence on a hostile regime because of Biden's energy policy. You just can't make this stuff up.
No, you can't. But I think you can explain it by thinking about the implications of having someone who has been, compromised is the genteel term for it, captured, I think is perhaps more accurate, by the Chinese Communist Party, serving as, our chief executive, our commander in chief, our president. And on this point, Gordon, again, you understand the mindset, you've been studying the tactics. Something that is so, adding insult to injury, I guess is the term for it, about all this is the hypocrisy of the Chinese. Their willingness to profess their commitment to A, the concern about climate change, and B, trying to mitigate it, when in fact their policies are exactly the opposite. And in fact, somebody observed the other day that from the Chinese point of view, if the climate is in fact warming and parts of their northern reaches might be more arable in terms of, you know, food growing, the worse the better, you know, get it hotter, so that they simultaneously can deprive us of energy we vitally need, both strategically and for our own economy, but also benefit from making things worse if, in fact, man-induced effects are contributing significantly to climate change. Just talk us through a little bit about, you know, what's the game here as Beijing sees it?
Well, China's game is to take advantage of climate change fervor in the Biden administration to increase America's dependence on China. That's clear. And as you point out, you know, they're building coal plants. They're not reducing their carbon emissions at all. And you know, when you think about it, this is Obama's Paris Accords. They gave those Paris Accords, as I mentioned, gave China every incentive to put more carbon into the air. So, you know, they're just taking advantage of a terribly misguided climate policy of the Obama administration, which Biden is not trying to change. Trump was right to take us out of the Paris Accords. Biden was wrong to put us back in.
Right. And Gordon, back to a point that you made earlier on supply chain dependencies in this excellent program we did last week, and people can find it and all of these webinars at presentdangerchina.org. One of our guests, Ross Kennedy, talked very powerfully about how the kinds of supply chains we've come to depend upon for food production in our country, one of the relatively few areas in which we still have a competitive advantage, is heavily dependent upon fertilizers and amino acids and vitamins for livestock that are not coming from China in anything like the, you know, needed supply. And this is, again, perhaps a straw in the wind that they're hoarding some of that for their own purposes. They want to deny it to us for our own consumption and use, as well as our exports. So again, we're up against a very serious adversary who, I think for the reasons we've been talking about throughout the program, is deadly serious about dominating us, not just supplanting us. And the question is, you know, the level of destruction that might be entailed. Closing thought?
Well, you know, just one point here is that the Communist Party views the United States as an existential threat. And it's not because of anything that we say or do, but it's because of who we are. You have an insecure regime in China that is worried about the inspirational impact of American values and form of governance on the Chinese people. So there's only going to be one survivor. It's going to be the United States of America, or it's going to be the People's Republic of China. It cannot be both. And it cannot be both, not because of us, but because of them. And that has to guide all of our policy decisions. And unfortunately, that is not understood by President Biden, but it's also not understood by Democrats and Republicans. And matter of fact, Frank, some of the people who hold views that are most favorable to communist China are conservative Republicans. So this is a bipartisan failure.
It is a bipartisan failure, elite captured, contributing to it, I think. Gordon Chang, thank you for this excellent conversation. We look forward to visiting with you next time. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with my colleague Kyle Scheidler about trouble on the home front right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If elected president, Senator Barack Obama promised a fundamental transformation of the United States of America. In the course of what's been called his third term, a nominal Biden administration dominated by Obama's staff is in the process of fundamentally transforming the world. Reflect, for example, on the Middle East at the end of Donald Trump's presidency. Our most important regional ally, Israel, had arguably never been stronger. Its strategic alliance with the U.S. was robust, encouraging stability through peace accords with former adversaries and isolating and deterring their common enemy, Iran. As an extremely timely Center for Security Policy webinar yesterday made clear, Israel is now isolated, undermined by Biden's Obama retreads, dangerously divided at home and facing an array of emboldened foes, including a nuclear-capable Iran, backed by communist China. That's a formula literally for disaster. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, the director of our Homeland Security Programs. His name is Kyle Scheidler. He has been, he has been making an outsized impact on a variety of aspects of the Homeland Security challenge that we're currently facing, including with a very important book entitled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. And boy, is that ever a timely contribution, Kyle. Welcome once again to Securing America. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I want to talk before we get to Antifa and some of its friends, or maybe as an introduction to it, for that matter, to talk to you a little bit about a shooting that has taken place recently in Nashville, Tennessee, one in which an individual we're not hearing an awful lot about murdered six people, three adults and three children, in a Christian elementary school. Tell us about the sorts of things that have not yet been fully exposed that ought to be understood about this individual and potential problems from others sharing that individual's views.
Sure. So what we know so far is that the perpetrator was a 28-year-old female who was undergoing a female-to-male transgender transition. And she attacked this school. She was apparently a former attendee of that school. It's a grade school, so this would have been several years ago that she was in attendance. We know that she left a manifesto. We do not yet know what the contents of that manifesto are. Nashville police have indicated that her transgenderism may have some role in her motivation, but we don't know exactly what. There are calls, of course, for the police to release this manifesto. They've been resistant to doing that, saying that their investigation is still open. The most recent thing I saw was that they do intend to release the manifesto at some point. Obviously, that will create, should hopefully answer a number of questions as to what exactly this person's motivations are. There's reasons to suspect, or at least to investigate the question of whether or not she was not engaging in a political act of terrorism in this attack and not responding purely out of her own emotional disorder or animosity. And the reason for that is coming up this week is a pre-scheduled, what's being called a Transgender Day of Vengeance, which a number of trans liberation organizations have promoted on social media for several weeks now. And it's due to come up shortly. So the question that obviously should spring to mind in any good investigator is, are these two events linked? Was this attack timed to take place to be linked to that so-called Day of Vengeance? Many people are not aware of this.
What do we know about this day of vengeance? What is the vengeance that they are ostensibly seeking? Do you have any idea?
So it's the day of vengeance is itself timed for the Transgender Day of Visibility, which is an LGBT community event that has been scheduled for some time. But the argument here by trans liberation groups is essentially that transgender people are being genocided, and that's a term that they explicitly use, by efforts by lawmakers to prevent the chemical transition of children into transgender individuals. Tennessee recently passed laws to that effect, which of course is another reason to believe that this attack may have political motivations and not just individual emotional motivations from the perpetrator.
So it is genocide if you prevent someone from becoming, at a very young age, a transgender individual. Is that the theory of the
case?
That's
how they see it, yes.
Therefore, they should be exacting vengeance against Christians they seem to hold responsible for this view?
That's right. And there is a strong movement within the transgender community towards what in Antifa they call community armed self-defense, which means the taking up of arms in order to enforce minority views. It's not the traditional American understanding of self-defense, where each individual, of course, has a right to bear arms guaranteed to us by our Bill of Rights. It's a communal or collectivized view that says if you do not give them the rights that they demand, which in this case involve things like the transition of children, then you are oppressing them and they have a right to defend themselves. So it's a very different understanding of the right to bear arms than the traditional American one, but it's very, very prevalent in certain elements and certain subsections of the transgender movement. You can see it displayed at some of these Antifa events where individuals will have patches on their body armor related to the transgender movement. You'll see things like Defend Equality with an AK-47 flag on it, these sorts of statements. So it is a growing subsection of the transgender movement that combines these two concepts, these concepts of being armed and fighting back against those people that they view as their oppressors. And so there is a genuine political movement that feels this way. And we need to find out whether this perpetrator in the Nashville case was a member of that community, whether she saw things that way, whether she saw her attack as motivated for that political purpose, because that would make it an act of terrorism, not just the act of a single emotionally disturbed individual.
And quite possibly tied, as you say, to other acts that may be now in prospect at the hands of like-minded individuals. All the more reason why any evidence about her mindset and plans and intentions ought to be made known, including this manifesto, of course.
And affiliations. Did anyone teach her to teach her firearms? Did anybody tell her what weapons to acquire? These are legitimate questions. There are ongoing right now crowdfunding campaigns to pay for firearms training for transgender individuals within this community. Now, of course, I support the right of every American to train with firearms if they choose to do that. But again, we have to remember that the political motivation behind these acts is not the same as the individual rights of the Second Amendment that most of us are familiar with.
And training for what purpose, I think, is the point you've also made. Self-defense is one thing. Offensive operations
are something very different.
Aimed at innocents, especially, is a totally different thing. We have to take a very short break, Kyle. We'll be right back with more. We're going to talk about Antifa and some of its associates and their agenda for all of us. Stay tuned for more right after this. Welcome back. Kyle Scheidler is with us. He directs the Homeland Security Project of our Center for Security Policy. He does it brilliantly, and we're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him and learn from him about that work and some of its important insights for the challenge we're all facing, notably from the radical left. He is the editor and contributor to an important book titled Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. And Kyle, you sort of touched there on the end of the previous segment to the possibility that this individual who perpetrated the attacks on this elementary school in Nashville, perhaps as a political terrorist action tied perhaps to this day of vengeance now upcoming, but also perhaps may have ties into elements of Antifa as well. Give us whatever you think might suggest there is that kind of tie-in and what we might be expecting as a result coming forward.
Well, as I said, there's a strong element of this transgender liberation armed subsegment, which is affiliated with Antifa, which operates on Antifa principles, and a high number of Antifa members who are themselves transgender. So,
and just a word on those Antifa principles, how would you characterize them where you see that intersection?
So it's, again, it's this concept of community armed self-defense, that Antifa exists to defend minority oppressed classes of people. So this is why you see the black garbed Antifa people in their body armor and firearms outside of these drag shows in Texas, for example. They view their role as defending this so-called community against the mainstream. So there's the connection there. So that's why I think it's very important for law enforcement to investigate whether there were any connections in this case. We don't know that for a fact, but it's worth looking into.
As you've documented in describing this as a growing threat, what they characterize as defending minority populations is often offensive operations against a majority, which may or may not have anything to do with the putative threats to that minority. And I guess, especially children in an elementary school in Nashville seem to have nothing to do with that at all. Talk, if you would, about groups like the National Lawyers Guild, which seem to be now playing a role in support of Antifa's violence by waging, I guess, what's being called lawfare on the behalf of the perpetrators.
Well, as you know, Frank, and as your audience may be aware, there was a pretty major development at Stanford University Law School a couple weeks ago where they essentially hounded a conservative speaker.
A federal judge.
Yeah, quite seriously. And the main perpetrators of that aggressive protest was the National Lawyers Guild. This is not at all surprising. The National Lawyers Guild goes back to the 1930s. They were known at the time as an arm of the Communist Party of the United States, explicitly created for the purpose of defending revolutionaries in the United States and for engaging in lawfare in order to change our laws in ways that were more favorable to the Communist Party of the United States. It's for example, it's the reason why you had a number of lawsuits that undermined U.S. sedition laws in the 40s and 50s. And during the 1960s and the 1970s, when you had the rise of new left terrorism, like the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, the Weather Underground, all of whom are the antecedents of today's BLM and Antifa rioters and violent actors, the National Lawyers Guild was joined with them at the hip, helping them, fundraising for them, keeping them out of jail, in some cases even smuggling firearms to them to break them out of jail in one very infamous case. And this is who the National Lawyers Guild is. This is what they exist to do. They are not a group of lawyers who care about people's civil rights. There are documented examples of National Lawyers Guild members throwing their own clients under the bus to protect what they call the movement. they explicitly engage in what they call movement lawyering, which means they exist to defend their far left Marxist movement. They don't exist necessarily to defend their individual client. Yeah. And so,
let alone the rule of law,
or let alone, nor are they a friendly officer of the court who is out in the interests of justice, whatever that may be.
Right. Alan Dershowitz had a very interesting piece at the Gatestone Institute about this. And this is a lawyer on the left, of course, a very prominent one, but a responsible liberal lawyer, as opposed to one of these radical communists, in this case, I think, of the National Lawyers Guild. He's very critical of these operations. And I guess, Kyle, one of the things I just would like to get your thoughts on, because I think many of us are deeply concerned, especially as we look at the Justice Department of Joe Biden and the kinds of prosecutions that have been going on, the January 6th defendants, as they're called, and so much more, what they're doing to Donald Trump. The rule of law seems at the moment to be really perilously close to no longer applying in the form of equal justice under the law, one of our foundational principles. And I wonder, when you look at what's going on at Stanford Law School and law schools all over the country, and you look at the obvious engagement and still seemingly considerable influence of the National Lawyers Guild, a communist front inculcating where it can the radical left's agenda, what on earth are the prospects for attorneys of the next generation and the rule of law going forward, do you think?
Oh, well, it's drastically concerning. I mean, if you have conservative or even mainstream liberal lawyers like Alan Dershowitz chased out of law schools in this country, what are you going to get? You're going to get National Lawyers Guild lawyers who exist for one purpose, and it's not to defend every individual's civil rights. They defend only the civil rights of the people that they want to defend, and they have no problem.
And they may not be all that civil rights, for that matter. It may be some of their extreme rights or their extreme behavior, at the very least, aimed at destroying everybody else's civil rights. Kyle, I hate to cut you off. We are out of time. I want you to come back soon, and let's continue this conversation. Your insights and the work you do at the Center for Security Policy is invaluable. We appreciate it tremendously.
Thank you, Frank.
God bless you. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I hope you'll come back to us next time as well. And until then, that you'll go forth and multiply.